the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history.
Hi, thanks for listening to Sake on Air. This is Frank. I'm filling in for Justin this week because he is on a long-deserved vacation. For the show this week, we have a great interview recorded with Wolfgang Agnol, the CEO of Riedel Japan. In fact, when we did this recording, he also ran a tasting for us using the Riedel glassware. We'll be releasing a bonus recording of that tasting session next week. I hope you enjoy the show today.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting us to Sake on Air. I'm Wolfgang Agnol. I'm come originally from Austria, from the mountains of Tyrol. And it's the first time I came to Japan in 1985. There was at the occasion of an event that was just happened to be in Japan, which was called the World Skills organization. This event is organizing a kind of a world championship for vocational skills for young people under 21. So I participated as Austria's representative for hotel and restaurant service. So originally from the hotel industry, service was my choice. They had, I think, over 30 other categories of from mechatronics to graphic design to beauty therapy, cooking, luckily I did quite well at the competition, and I think it's due to Japan. I think I won. Had it not been in Japan, I think I would have been second or third. I think the Swiss or the German would have beaten me. And because I think it was, thinking back, it was judo at 4 years old that helped me. And turning back, I was able to, I had an intuitive understanding of Japan in some way from that early experience. I trusted my Japanese assistants. So every competitor got two assistants to help them with getting materials from the backyard. And I communicated quite rather well with them. And the German and the Swiss, they did it themselves because they didn't trust their assistants. And I think that's how I won and felt an affinity with Japan. Tried to find a way back, and it took me 3 years to find a way, and ended up in Osaka at the Tsuji Academy, at Tsuji Culinary Institute, and was teaching about hotel and restaurant service for a year. But I wanted to always to be in business, and during that time I contacted Riedel because I was very familiar with the product. It was a product I really could identify with, and first, I think he actually threw me out of the office because he thought, as a young 21-year-old, what's he going to do for us in Japan? But after a while, I started basically in Tokyo to work for Riedel in 89. And since then, been in Japan until 95 for 7 years. I went to Sydney for Riedel. Also still taking care of Japan for 5 years, covering Riedel's business in Asia-Pacific, Latin America, and Africa. And then in the year 2000, I came back to Japan to start the Riedel subsidiary. And I've been back since. So,
how important is Riedel for, I mean, Japan for Riedel?
The Japanese market as a country, it's, I think, the second biggest market after the US as a country. So we have different ways to look at the world. In Japan also, we have a substantial retail business, our own direct retail business. We have 15 of our own stores, 3 freestanding stores, an outlet store, and 11 shopping shops in department stores. And of course, online business and hotel restaurant business, which is also quite important for us. We also take care of two of our sister brands called Nachbarn and Spiegelau.
Would you mind going over the Riedel philosophy that inspires sort of your work and your guidelines for the products that you create? Just really briefly what that is?
For us, the content is really what determines the shape of a glass. I mean, we look at glassware or drink, the enjoyment of beverages in a completely Epicurean way. It's a sensory, it's all about sensory pleasure. So we do not make glasses to taste or professional tasting glasses. I mean, although some of the glasses work quite well as tasting glasses, but the main purpose of our philosophy is to, our mission is to create ideal shapes that will maximize a beverage's harmony and highlight its unique characteristics. And as such, we first and foremost, we look at the beverage itself, the basic composition of the beverage itself, the flavor composition, before we look into other elements like aesthetics, for example. For us, always aesthetics come last. Form follows function in our case. So we really follow the Bauhaus principle in this sense. I think one of the key points also for when we look at designing glasses is that all shapes or all glasses are fit to human physiology and human anatomy, and especially also the ergonomics. Because most anatomy and physiology across different cultures is fairly consistent. What is different is the composition of the beverage. And the least important in our case is the aesthetics. So the design itself is maybe beautiful, but really shape and size, especially size, is very, very important when it comes to the capturing of the aromas as well as the flow of the liquid to your palate.
What you mean by human anatomy is the size and the shape of the mouth, is the angle of the head.
Yes, it's correct.
It's how the body takes.
It is your ergonomics with a physical object. You will reach out with your hands to a glass. You have four fingers. They're mostly similar sizes. So four fingers will, for example, fit onto the stem of this glass very comfortably. I don't have to squeeze myself into reach it. My eyesight will determine how much liquid is in the glass. And it will already send you a message as to how fast you will drink, or how cautiously you will approach the drinking mechanism. Also, the when we talk about the aromas, the aromas inside of a glass, and we will see later that it's really important to have egg-shaped, convex-shaped glasses to even be able to physically capture aromas. You must have this kind of convex shape. You will also have it determines the size of the size of the rim, the shape of the rim, the amount of liquid in the glass, the overall shape and proportions determine the intensity as well as the quality of aromas. And when we talk about the drinking flow, you will the head, every time you drink from a vessel, is it a glass, a bottle, a straw, the position of your head will be different, the angle will be different, the position of your tongue will be different, the shape of your tongue will be different. It will offer a different surface area to the liquid every time you drink from a different vessel. And the speed, depending on the slant of your head, the speed of the velocity of the liquid when it enters your mouth will be different, because liquids flow by gravity. And if we lean backwards, the liquid will flow down. And if we don't lean backwards, the liquid cannot flow down. It will stop in the middle of your mouth. So just to give you a bit of a background of the history of our involvement with sake in general, is that when we came in the mid-90s to Japan, and to sort of broadly introduce the Riedel concept across the country, one of the first questions, since Japanese discovered basically for the first time that the glass shape can make a big impact on the aroma and taste of wine, one of the first questions that we received was, well, what about sake? We did not have an answer. We had, because we didn't know sake, and we were very reluctant to even touch the subject because of sake being so entrenched in tradition and in culture. So we did not, for us, this was quite a hot potato. not knowing anything about it, and it was completely unfamiliar to us. So it was not until 97, that we received a quite unusual request from a maker in Kanazawa, from Fukumitsuya. They told us basically that we've bought all your shapes, all your 26 different varietal specific shapes, and we have tasted all our sakes in it, and we believe that there's a few shapes in there that, I mean, that blew us away, that they delivered aromas that we never have smelled before. And we really would like you to start to make a sake glass. And we cautiously met them, reluctantly met them actually in Hong Kong for the first time at Vinexpo, because they were exhibiting there, and came back to Japan, did some orientation workshops in Kanazawa, and also got the owner, George Riedel, involved, also to get, at that time, John Gountner, the three of them, basically then determined that Daiginjo, the Daiginjo category should be the target and not just the sake glass. It should be more specific, because Daiginjo is the aromatic variety, the more aromatic variety, much closer to wine than any other sake, which commands, we knew it had to, it commanded an egg shape, it commanded a convex shape, because in order to capture aromas, you will need to have a convex shape. We continued in Bordeaux with 20 brewers from a organization called Hakokai at the time. I mean, these were the young brewers at that time. They are the old ones now, 20 years later. We started off with 100 different shapes that went, we brought down to 60 and 30, and narrowed down to 12 shapes. And this is when the actual official workshop started. So prior to that, it was only a preliminary workshop for us to get orientation of which direction we are going to, what are they looking for, what are the makers looking for. And it's not us putting any votes into this, it is really us facilitating the process. The results, the elimination, was exclusively done by the brewers and the participants. We did further workshops across Japan, because we really needed to have to narrow it down further down to 6 shapes. Because it only makes sense to do final workshops with a smaller number, otherwise it's getting too broad. We sent those 6 prototypes to members of the Daiginjo Association, and overall there was 45 different brewers involved in the individual evaluation. We received their results, we recorded them, because we wanted to match those against the final official workshop at the Austrian Embassy in 1999 already, so that is also 20 years ago now, which was hosted by the ambassador and George Riedel, and 12 sake breweries that then chose the one shape that you also have now in front of you. It is a sake glass. It is a glass specifically made for sake. It is varietal specific, but it looks pretty much like a generic white wine glass, so nothing really spectacular overseas. But in Japan, this was quite a revolution, because we did also have some resistance across along the way. I remember one workshop in Mito, north of Tokyo, where there was quite a older generation demographic participating, and they helped us out. They lent us their palettes, so to speak, but they weren't really sure what we were actually doing. They pretty much eliminated, rated exactly the same way as all the other brewers. They eliminated all the small vessels, because we put very small vessels that are like ochoko-like sizes on stems, because we have those from our ODV collection, and they were immediately eliminated. But when they realized what we were doing, they immediately shifted their votes back to the small vessels, because they were afraid that it would interfere with the culture, with the cultural way of drinking sake. So we put the question to our group of other friends, the younger, more progressive brewers at the time, and they really pushed us. They said, no, you must do this. You have to do this, because without vessels that non-Japanese are familiar with, that they can easily integrate into their lifestyle, there will be no growth outside of Japan. it will, as long as it, if it stays within the culture, it's very hard. It, there will be limitations on the proliferation of sake in general if it comes together with Japanese cuisine or only with Japanese culture. We also made a version without the stem, which became very, very popular. And then 10 years later, so we're talking in decades, we made an event with different brewers, and they really they requested a Junmai glass. Junmai glasses were requested throughout, since ever we started making sake glasses. But it was then that they really said again, we need a glass for Junmai. At the same time, we also had a dilemma, because overseas, people called the Daiginjo glass the Riedel sake glass. And that was always a dilemma for us, because it never was a sake glass. It always was a glass specifically for Daiginjo. So we knew we were interested to set the record straight in this respect, but we didn't know where to start. We started with John Gantner. Also, we always started with John, actually, I have to say. It was always very, very helpful to have him on board. We started off with, I think, 60 different shapes initially. The selection of sake was interesting, because they chose, they recommended a sake, the industry recommended a sake that we didn't judge the selection of the sake, but it was a very Ginjo-like Junmai. And immediately I remember that Philip Harper, who was also a participant in these initial workshops, said, well, this is not Junmai. So our feelers were a little bit on alert. And this was already an indication of what may or may come, which was a split in the industry of what Junmai actually is. And we added a more traditional Junmai style to the mix. We did hearings and workshops with brewers. But we have to say that the results were split. There was a group that said, this is the glass that we want to promote, or this is the Junmai that we believe is Junmai. The other group favored a style that was more egg-shaped. They wanted to reduce the aroma. I can't actually remember exactly what the individual comments were, but we just know from the numbers that we received when we got there, when we wrote down the numbers, we came to this result. And the result was that we had to stop. We had to pull the plug from the project, because it's not our place to determine what is Junmai. And we just felt it was too early, so we stopped the project. And it was only 4 years later, in 2017, that we restarted. The industry has changed. Also, we got increasing inquiries from overseas. Chefs started to integrate umami-laden ingredients into their food. They wanted to pair it with Junmai rather than Ginjo style. And we knew the time was right, was more ripe. So we restarted the project in 2017. This was the basic premise. And we also included Junmais on the very end of the Junmai spectrum. Much more richer, much more umami-rich styles that we did not have included in 2010. This was the basic flavor profiles that we were aiming for. So we were targeting this flavor profile, very full body, umami rich character, and versus the Daiginjo glass, which is a lot cleaner and lighter body. We started with first prototypes. That was the first round of prototypes. We started in Daishichi in Yamagata Prefecture, Fukushima Prefecture. Sorry, was Daishichi. Why? Because Mr. Ota from Daishichi already told us in 20 years earlier that his Kimoto tastes really, really great out of the Riedel Monrache glasses, which are very wide and open shapes. So we had this already in the back of the mind, so he was the perfect place to start. We continued with other brewers. Here is Tomita Shuzo. And after the first initial orientation sessions, We knew which classes to eliminate, and the ones that were first eliminated was Daiginjo shapes, the sort of egg shapes, smaller shapes, and some other shapes. So we knew the direction. I went to Austria to talk to George Riedel because his input is always extremely valuable and vital for these kind of projects, because he has always these gold nuggets of ideas that really push the envelope, and he did. Because he said he rejected those flower pots for ergonomic reasons. I said, this is not a design language that I would like to promote, that I would like to release. This cannot be comfortably held by a lady in one hand. These glasses must have a stem. Originally, we thought it was a great idea to have stemless glasses, because that would really pair well with our Daiginjo glass, which is stemless, and we could make a very nice set. We thought it's quite neat, but he said this must have a stem, and it must be, you must comfortably hold it in your hand, and it must elevate the sake experience to the level of wine on any table around the world. And this was his key message for this session. He also introduced, in addition to round shapes, I will maybe talk about later, about the velocity of the liquid when it enters our mouth. Round shapes are much faster, higher velocity, much faster flow than diamond shapes. And so George Riedel included some diamond shapes into the mix, and we made new prototypes and put those final shapes into the race as a preliminary. This was the semi-finals, actually. Different diamond shapes, different egg shapes. And we went back, we talked to professionals individually, not talk, but actually tasted them. I think it was 42 different separate workshops that we did in Japan within 2 years. The biggest tasting, the most intense tasting I remember was with Philip Harper. He tasted all of his sakes in all of the glasses, which nobody has done, and we were there for 4 hours, and the result was very, very interesting. Back to Tokyo, we worked with the International Sake Challenge judges, also separately. Every time we do a workshop, the evaluation is private, is individual, that we ask for not to speak to each other, not to influence each other, not to disregard personal aesthetical preferences, maybe operational preferences. Somebody may say, why, I don't like this kind of shape in my brewery. I don't want to taste from this. And because at this stage, it's all about aroma and taste and texture. This was the result of the second stage of the workshops, and we had a clear direction, and we knew exactly which shape had to go into the final. So it's 100% transparent, and to really safeguard the integrity of the whole process and to make it as transparent as possible. These are the finalists, two round shapes, three diamond shapes. And we made sure that we did two separate final workshops, one in Nagoya with 12 brewers. And they chose glass number 5 as the winner. And 2 days later, we did the same with different brewers, different sakes in Tokyo. And we also, number 5 was the clear winner. And they did not know about their results. They did not talk to each other. And it's impossible anyway to manipulate the result, because the voting and the elimination is done open. So everybody has to raise their hand at the same time and vote and eliminate. And everything is transparent. Everybody can see what happens. We also made sure that we also got some consumer requests. People were complaining, well, how do I handle this thing? It doesn't look like, it's not a wine glass, it's not a cocktail glass, and if I swirl it too heavily, it might even spill. So we gave it very clear instructions. We say that you, the maximum server level, service level from both glasses is about 80 milliliters. The recommended drinking temperature for our purposes, for drinking it at up to room temperature, is 15 to 20 degrees. This is also the temperatures the glasses were workshopped at. And for Daiginjo, it's much lower, of course, between 10 and 15 degrees for the two types of sake. We know that there is other shapes on this map, on this flavor map, between Jumai and Daiginjo. And those two labels, I call them labels. For us, Daiginjo is a label that represents the most characteristic character of the style of sake. Same with Jumai. There is, of course, you know, there's many different variations, and there's probably many different shapes in here, but these would be our two anchor shapes that we have right now after 20 years of involvement with sake. That is a first initial tour through the history of the development. Mm. So if you have any question.
I do have a bit of context to give you guys, is that Wolfgang and I would go out to an izakaya. We went out, yes, to an izakaya. Mm. Because Wolfgang just really couldn't let go of the project, I'm thinking now, because you decided on your shape. You had your shape. It was in production. And you were still so involved in the project. And I think now, talking to you now and thinking back to that dinner that we were having, how difficult was it to let go?
Well, it's intense because you have to dig very deep, and sake is unlimited in its depth, in it's so complex, and you get lost so easily. And I think it's just to have reached the bottom of the sea and reached a certain ground, and I can stand on it, and it's now it's very easy actually to look at sake, and I would say I have found an understanding, a depth of understanding that allows me to navigate sake now really freely, without any crutches or without help. I have a compass. I have orientation. I know where to go, and I can really swim
and
freely.
And what's really wonderful is it's your own compass in terms of, this has happened while this has been a business project, a very serious business project. Within that, you've also had a personal journey, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
No. And so you're the direction that you move within the sake world is informed by, of course, the business element, but more importantly, what you've experienced along the way.
Yes, yes, yes. No, it's been a journey, but at the same time, it's very important. It's the DNA of the brand. Mm. Is the integrity of its process, how to arrive at certain shapes, and this is really what the real philosophy is all about. And I'm the custodian of that philosophy here in
and
Japan.
And you're really strict, so the weight has been very heavy. Yeah. I did the tasting, and it was no more friends, Rebecca. It was, don't think about aesthetics. Stop thinking about what you like. Stop thinking. Mm-hmm. Just taste. And you were really, really strict from beginning to end, and it was great because you kept us in line, you kept us disciplined, and you made it purely about process, which was a revelation when we came to, within our small little tasting that we did, what shape we came to in the end.
Yes.
Let's just make very quickly, I don't want to focus too much on it, but you have, this hasn't all been like an easy ride as far as getting this, selling this to the end consumer, yes, right? Or where the end consumer, yes, is. But you've had, I think, quite a lot of negative feedback as well, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
I know,
yes.
You're very good at dealing with it.
And no, then, I mean, we did have some very initial surprising reactions from some corners of the industry. The interesting was, they had the brewers were excited, consumers were highly curious and very embraced it really easily. But then we, our mistake was that we did not provide the manual for the glass that we made and did not have all the support information of how we did we end up with the shape. There were some sake experts outside of Japan that did not know Riedel. And if they don't know Riedel, they don't know what to expect. And they didn't know about the workshop process that we did and the development and who was behind it and so forth. So for them is like, and they were kind of, they grew up in the cultural and the traditional way to enjoy sake, which is fantastic, but they were in that world.
They just saw a wine glass, basically. Yes,
they right. saw a glass, and who are these people from Riedel that bring this, and who are they to tell us what we should drink from? So.
But of course, once they understand that it's not just a wine glass, and they hear, you know, this story of how you actually put it together, then of course those objections can no longer exist.
If we were coming now into the sake world, some of those arguments may have been justified because you know, okay, now we see an opportunity with sake. We enter this, we enter the world of sake as you know the wine glass company, but we were working on this already 20 years ago.
But I mean, if I can, you know, turn this and spin this into a positive, I do know someone that was a sake expert from outside of Japan that did have a very strong opinion. And you graciously guided that person to a point of understanding, and not only just a point of understanding, a point of realization, which is, you know, it's really, I think it's proof that this isn't just a shape, that what is behind it. Yes, of course, there is a science, there's a technique behind selecting the shape, but along the way in the selection process and the delivery of the product to the market, you're very, very much about inclusivity and listening, hearing people and supporting them.
I mean, I may have had the same rejection or same reaction as he had to seeing
the
glasses.
I think maybe I would have as well, actually.
Couldn't blame him. So all I needed to tell him is show him.
He or she, we're not specifying.
No, he or she.
No, now actually he has become a very, very good friend and a brother in arms of about the whole thing. And it's probably, I would say, one of the most incredible engagement interactions I ever had with anybody in this kind of way, and it was a revelation also for me to have that and to be able to.
I think that person through the course of the conversation would have been phenomenally surprised with your depth of knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
I think that would have also been an important outcome.
They've openly said that as well. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we can get them on the show and get their actual side of the story.
Yes. Great.
More fair, isn't it?
Yes.
What's fascinating is how when you approach the glass from your mouth and nose, actually your brain has already a very strong, idea about what to expect and how it will do.
Yes, we do. All our senses are involved. And this is perhaps... All our senses are involved, and this is really, I think, maybe the most important journey for any beverage, including sake. If you look at the journeys that sake makes or wine makes, from the rice field to the brewery, from the brewery into the bottle, from the bottle into the vessel, but the one we always forget about is the delivery, the journey from the vessel to our five senses, where we touch the vessel, when we smell the aromas, when we taste and feel the texture of the liquid, and even with glasses and maybe with other vessels it's a little more difficult, you have even the sense of hearing involved in your sensory experience of enjoying a drink.
Maybe I'm a very tactile person, maybe that's the reason, but I'm always curious and interested in the weight of my glass. I love playing with weight, not just shapes or so forth, but for example, you have beautiful lacquerware and it's lovely and light, but it looks heavy. And so I love that sort sort of trickery that tricks my mind to think it's going to be heavy, but it's actually quite light. Or, you know, that really, really fine Usuhari glass. I love how I, when I hold it, I think, this is going to be so gentle and crisp and lovely. Or something that's rich and earthen and heavy. I'm thinking, oh, this sake is going to be delicious. Like, my mind's telling me based on weight. And I wonder, is weight something that you also consider?
Yes, absolutely. We have, I mean, it depends on the weight is very, very important. And you may be very, it's more sensitive or more attuned to the tactile experience of holding a vessel. But everybody is to some extent. But this is only a question of the glass execution. You blow it thinner or you blow it thicker. If you are in banquet, it's very difficult to have a thick glass. If you have a very small, fine restaurant, you can have it as thin as paper. That is an aesthetic or a different appeals to a different sensation. We also have very, very super thin glasses, which we call super leggero, which is called super light. In the wine glass, we also have this for Daiginjo and Junmai. So we do offer this as well, but for us, it is always the tactile is only one sense that is engaged when we appreciate the wine. And what we're real is really at the forefront of things is aroma, taste, and texture in the mouth.
So, as a follow-up question, then, in your Epicurean approach, something like the tactile nature, the weightiness, or the texture of the vessel, is more in terms that's more aesthetics or sensory rather than the delivery of the beverage, and it's not something that would maybe maximize, as you said, the harmony and the unique characters of the beverage.
Yes, correct. I mean, it is the sense of touch of your hands is involved. It's not your sense of touch in your mouth that is involved when you hold the beverage. So the sense of touch, I agree, there is probably a shape that is so thin that you're just feeling you're holding the liquid. And when you put it to your mouth, to your lips, you feel like it's perfectly it's a perfect sensation on your lips, but it does not. It is the shape that determines the flow, not the thickness. Of course, if you have a rolled rim, a very thick rim, it will also affect the flow. But it is when you put it to the lips. It's really we are thinking about the liquid. We are thinking about the sake or the wine in the glass, and to maximize the harmony of that, and to really get the best out of each beverage.
I mean, we have beautiful sets. Are you doing this regularly or printed for us specially?
No, unfortunately, we do use this set also for our customers. So we offer this set in our stores where we have a tasting bar where we where we do these tastings, these glass tastings, as we call them, sensory workshops, as we call them, for consumers, for anybody that would like to book a tasting.
I'm curious, what is the demographic and profile of most of the people who come to your workshops? Is it predominantly 30-somethings? Is it a little bit more widespread? Is it Japanese or inbound or
foreign definitely residents? Japanese. Right. Japanese, I would say. I mean, many of our customers have known the Daiginjo glass. The Daiginjo glass has been around for 20 years. We it's consistently selling in Japan. It's quite popular as a gift also. And the curiosity, I mean, people are extremely curious, and it's not just brewers, it's not just industry professionals, but especially consumers, because they know the Riedel story. If you don't know the Riedel philosophy of content determines shape, and how it affects your perception of beverages. It may surprise you to have these kind of glasses in front of you, or especially this Junmai glass. But if you know the Riedel from the wine glass side, then people are extremely curious about it, and it's from all demographics. That I could not say that there is. It's more older or younger. They all of them actually are interested. Maybe they're more interested in the Juma glass because it's a little bit less expensive than the Daginja glass.
Pavgon, what should we do about the tasting? I mean,
I've already started.
And that wraps it up for this week. Thanks for listening. Sake on Air is broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center and made possible with the generous support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association. It is a joint production between Potsuke Productions and Export Japan. You can find us on social media at Sake on Air, or you can reach out by email by messaging us at questions@sakeonair.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be releasing a special recording of the tasting next week. Until then, kanpai!